Welcome to the Leadership with Bianna Kovic show, and thank you for being with us. Our topic, leadership, focuses on leaders such as yourselves. We believe that leadership is a skill that can be learned through practice and awareness. It is our hope that our conversation will help you become more reflective when it comes to your own leadership practices and enable you to leave a positive legacy. Our very special guest is Anne Beaulieu. Anne is an emotional intelligence coach, speaker, and the author of The Emotionally Intelligent Way, a 20-plus book series that include adult fairy tales for developing emotional intelligence, case studies for emotional intelligence-driven sales, a comic strip called The EQ Way, and a brand new Save Yourself series where she assists women make better emotionally intelligent decisions when it comes to money and finance. Besides leading in emotional intelligence, Anne is also an economist and a CFA. She speaks English, French, and Chinese Mandarin fluently. She has 3 adult children and a 16-year-old dog named Lucky. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bianna. It's a pleasure to be here. It's actually quite an honor. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Anne. So you are the founder of the Walking Inside Resources, and I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your company.
My pleasure. Walking Inside Resources, we are a coaching and consulting company. We specialize in developing emotional intelligence at home and in business. That's what we do.
So when you talk about emotional intelligence, I was wondering if you can talk to us a little bit more about it, because you're actually an expert at it. You wrote several books on it. And what I found interesting in your books is that you actually teach emotional intelligence.
I do. I've written 25 books. They're all available on Amazon. Emotional intelligence is something that is very important to me. It's important in leadership. It's important in our life. Emotional intelligence is pervasive to every area of our life, because emotional intelligence has 4 quadrants. The first quadrant, if we take a piece of paper and divide it in 4, in the top corner, the left corner, that is what we call self-awareness. And self-awareness is understanding our feelings and emotions, where they come from, so that we can manage our relationship with ourselves. And in the top right corner, now from that self-awareness, we get to manage our relationship that we have with others. Not manage others, that's vastly different. Manage the relationship that we have with others. So that's how it goes. The reason why I teach emotional intelligence is because I am doing the journey. I am digging deep. I am understanding where my emotions, my feelings and emotions come from. My clients tell me that one of my strengths is that I can easily navigate someone's mind and debunk all the emotional paths, what we call limiting beliefs, that they may have. And the only reason that I can do that is because I have overcome those same blind spots. So I can see them easily and then guide the clients towards self-empowerment.
And I really appreciate you mentioning blind spots, because as leaders and as people, we all have those blind spots that we might not be aware of. So can you talk to us a little bit more of how can one become more aware of their own blind spots?
Well, I would say an easy process. I'm chuckling right now. It depends how resistant we are to change and to have to really examine ourselves. For example, someone may have a limiting belief, a blind spot around money. They might not understand why, for example, they may not be paid a salary, a higher salary, or why don't they have a better job, or why they got bypassed for that promotion. And all these things have to do with how a person views themselves. So they need to talk to themselves, but they need to really go in and ask, like, what is my limiting belief around getting paid a handsome salary come from? Like, who taught me that? And then usually when a person goes digging, they will start realizing, oh, when they were small, growing up, they might have heard their parents that, oh, money is hard to make, or, you know, got to work hard for the money. Those are just two limiting beliefs. And as children, we're like sponges. We take it in, we soak it all up, and then we turn around and we get to embody those beliefs. We get to live them. But those beliefs were never ours. They were our parents, but we took them on. And until we examine ourselves, we examine those beliefs, very little can be done. We will just keep repeating the past. So once a person gets their idea, I say, okay, I have a limiting belief around that. I see the results in my life around that. The next step becomes, if I don't change that limiting belief, what is going to happen to me? And that's usually when people stand in their own emotional poo-poo because they go like, oh my God, my life's going to suck. What am I going to do? This is not good. I must do something about it. And then the next step becomes, okay, what belief would you like to have? What belief would you like to hold that would be your own? And a person might choose a belief like money is easy to make, or I am good enough to be paid handsomely for what I do. And then it becomes implementing. And me as an EQ coach, I walk a client through all that process and I make sure that they are accountable to change that belief. It's like a person who goes on a diet and then on the first day, they're like, I can do this. On the second day, I can do this. On the third day, they go, oh goodness, this is so hard. I don't know if I can do this. And then they might go to the fridge and slip. As an EQ coach, I keep my clients focused and I move them towards their goal so that they get to overcome and change their limiting beliefs so that they get to experience the life that they want, whatever that is for them.
So is there like a time frame that you need to go through? Like, is it like 30, 60 days that it takes for that limiting belief to change? Or
we are creatures of habits, all of us. And what has been deeply ingrained in us, often it's very difficult to let it go. In my field, we say that the people are attached to their emotional crapola. For example, if we are in a family where our parents keep saying to this day, money is hard to make, and we come over for Thanksgiving dinner and we start blasting, money is easy to make, that might not go so well with them. They will challenge it because it's a change in the status quo. So a lot of people, they have to make a choice. It's what I tell all my clients, you must choose. You either choose your well-being or you choose other people's well-being above your own. It's always a choice. So for people, we can change a belief in a heartbeat if we wholeheartedly choose our well-being beyond the approval of others.
So you have to allow yourself not to look for approval from others.
Correct. But when you think about it, what does a small child want? Small child wants to be loved by his parents. It wants to be accepted. It wants to fit in. It wants to belong in something that is greater than itself, especially a family unit. So therefore, a small child will bend backwards to get that approval from their parents. So when those parents were the people who transferred, who downloaded those limiting beliefs onto the child, the child has to choose, and there's a child inside of us. Like, we must choose in every moment. Am I going to behave like an adult, or am I going to behave like a small child still craving the love of its parents?
So looking at the leadership nowadays, and obviously we are humans and we have limiting beliefs in our lives that we might have inherited from our family members, parents, and community even, how those limiting beliefs impact our leadership?
They do. There is a leadership principle that I live by. It was given to me by my mentor, Dolph Barron, who's considered one of the top leadership speakers in the world. And the leadership principle is, what we do is what we do everywhere. For example, when I was younger, if I'm going to chuckle at myself right now, I was a perfectionist. So when I would fold towels, it was all color-coded, and all four corners had to go really together, and all the towels had to be folded neatly into the cabinet. So if someone came to me and ask me a question like, hey, are you a team player? Because it's important in leadership to be a team player. I would say, of course I am. Of course I am. I'm a great team player. Meanwhile, when a project would come along, that perfectionist girl who at home was folding towels corner to corner, at work, she was looking at projects and trying to find what was wrong with it so that she could make it perfect her way, what she thought was right. So what we do is truly what we do everywhere. If we're a perfectionist at home, we're going to be a perfectionist at work. We carry our limiting beliefs everywhere. This is why, as a leader, it is crucial that we examine our limiting beliefs, because we get to transfer them onto others.
And I would just add even more, we get to lead others according to our limiting beliefs.
Correct. Correct. And we lead others to the extent that we lead ourselves. I often tell my clients, how many relationships do you think you have? And they start, I have a relationship with my husband, I have a relationship with my wife, I have a relationship with my dog, with my cat, with my kids, my mother, my father. And they go on and on and on. And I say, no, you have one relationship. And they go, say what? How can that be? I say, we are the vessel for our relationships. So basically, the relationship that we have with ourselves, that self-awareness that I talked about earlier, that determines the quality of every relationship that we have with others. So it's one vessel with everybody in it. So as a leader who gets to lead others, we lead them exactly the same way as we lead ourselves.
So in other words, the way you treat yourself is the way you treat others.
That's exactly right. You got it.
You know, it's so interesting because in music, we say the way you practice is the way you do other things, because I'm a musician, right? So we say the way you're going to practice is the way you're going to actually do many other things in your life.
I agree. What we practice is what we do. And our limiting beliefs, they dictate what we believe in. They dictate what we practice. Limiting beliefs are our comfort zone. It's what we know. It's what we grew up with. It's what we're familiar with. Our limiting beliefs are our blind spots. Until we have someone who sheds some light onto those beliefs, we will continue leading ourselves and others the way we've been taught from generation to generation. This is why emotional intelligence is so important.
And for someone who's been traveling the world, you're very eclectic, you speak several languages, Chinese, among other languages that you speak. I would be curious to know, are they cultural limiting beliefs that you encounter when you were coaching people from China versus from Canada versus American versus someone in Europe?
My mother tongue is French, so I speak French, English, and Chinese Mandarin. I lived 10 years in China. And while in China, I have experienced what you could say cultural differences. And people are people. So a lot of our limiting beliefs, when we look beyond race, gender, ethnicity, all these divisive factors, we realize that we actually pretty much wired the same. My clients come from all over the world, but it never ceases to amaze me how their limiting beliefs around money, around self-worth, around feeling good enough, how it's pretty much the same. It all came from the same source, their parents. They deal with cultural heritage the best they do. I had a friend in China who used to tell me, when she was like, you don't get it, Anne. It's like, we have 5,000 years of history. You are Canadian. You only have like 300. How can you possibly understand? I said, I understand from generation to generation what gets passed down the pipeline. There are families here that their history, their ancestry is very, very profound, where the traditions are upheld to a very, very high level. It's a matter of intensity. So for me, no matter where a person comes from in the world, what I've realized is when it comes to emotional intelligence, when it comes to limiting beliefs, we're pretty much all wired the same.
So basically, cultural beliefs are not as important as what you actually inherit from your parents?
Many people like to think so. This is my personal opinion. They might say, for example, a young woman in Africa who gets her genitals mutilated because she's a woman, how can that compare to a woman here who might have been raped several times? And when people start comparing cultural differences or stuff like that, I love to give them this example. I say, imagine you have two children in front of you. Both of them are 2 years old. One of them has never been hurt physically, emotionally. Their parents were loving. They hugged the child. The child, they said, I love you. They fed the child. They read them stories at night. They tucked them to bed with their teddy bear. Okay? And then you have a second child who every day, from the moment they were born to the age of two, they were slapped in the face every day for no reason. They would get slapped by their parents. So one day, both children get slapped in the face. So the child who's had everything and the child who you could say had nothing. So the question becomes, which child had it worse?
The one that's
been...
What would
you answer?
Yeah, I would say the one that was cuddled because she never experienced any type of violent behavior.
And that's also the answer that I said, because my mentor gave me that example years ago to make me more aware. And I was like, well, of course, it's the kid who was cuddled. It's the kid who received all this love. That poor kid must have been so shocked. Like, goodness gracious, it went from being like 100% love to like zero. What happened? And my mentor looked at me and he said, they're both children, Anne. How can you decide? They're both children.
Interesting.
I started crying. Who are we to decide how traumatic an experience is for a person? So therefore, in that light, cultural differences, they're all terrible in the sense that they're all hurtful. And there is not one more or less, you could say, quote unquote, bad than another. It's all relative. It's the person who is receiving that trauma. That's where our compassion needs to go.
That's very interesting. Yeah, very interesting, because one would think that if you get slapped so many times, you get trained to accept being slapped, but actually it's true. It's the person that receives.
Well, it just shows that like our tolerance level. I used to think that tolerance was a good thing. That was something that I had been taught growing up. But tolerance is actually accepting limiting beliefs. Like when I said that it was the kid who had been cuddled, because the other kid had tolerated for 2 years. So there was a part of my mind at the time that had gone into, well, that kid had already experienced it. He already knows violence. He's already living violence. So therefore, quote unquote, it's not as bad. It is that bad. So tolerance has a lot to do with limiting beliefs. What we tolerate persists. Mm-hmm.
What we tolerate, you said, persists?
It persists. It continues.
And why is that?
Because what we tolerate, we fail to take a stand on. We fail to know to express what we deeply feel inside about the position. Things that we tolerate, we don't like it, but we look the other way. That's tolerating for me. It's like I might see someone at the mall, a mother yelling at her kid. And tolerating for me would be averting my eyes and not saying or doing anything about it. That's tolerating. But when we tolerate something, then that mother might not know different. She might think it's okay to yell at her kid at the mall. But if someone were to walk up to her and say, if that child was your age, would you yell at this child the way you did now? And they might say, most likely, no. Of course not. They're adults. What makes it okay for you to yell at a child in a mall? Is it because of their size? Then they start thinking about bullying. They start thinking about everything. And then they walk away and, you know, they may contact me later and say, you know, I'm yelling a lot less these days. Because what we tolerate continues. Once we take a stand, it stops. And we get to bring another belief, a new belief. a more empowering belief.
You know, in business, we deal sometimes in New York City, where I am, I talked a lot on the show about it. There's lots of bullyish type of leadership where bosses are feeling they're the ones that run the show and you can't say anything to them. So people are basically discouraged to speak up because they're afraid of retaliation. From your perspective, you have to break that belief of being afraid to speak up. But if there is sort of a feeling of, if I do so, I might be fired, what advice do you have for these folks that have fear that they cannot speak up because they're not in position to do so?
Well, in the past, I used to be those people. I was what you call an emotional doormat. I was a people pleaser to the max. I had very low self-worth. Years and years ago, I had to do a lot of self-development work to love myself and feel worthy of my own love and attention and feel worthy of my own acceptance. So I used to be the fly on the wall. I would never rock the boat. I would phrase things so that it would be acceptable for others. The whole time I did that, the end result was I lost myself in the world of others. I became so externally focused on getting people's attention or people's approval that I completely forgot about myself, who I was, what I really wanted, and what I needed. Because if you would ask me a question like, what do you really want in your life? I would look at the person back then and go, I would look at them with big eyes and mouth open and not knowing what to say. As I started knowing myself and standing up for what I believe in, when I really felt my truth and stating my truth clearly, it's amazing the freedom it gives me. The freedom to be me, the freedom to own my greatness, to own my leadership. And as a result, people started following me because they wanted to, never because they had to. Did I make enemies along the way? Oh, goodness gracious. If you came, I have a Mac computer, like a 27-inch screen. If I were to go just on Facebook, just to name one to make people chuckle, and you would look at my blog, it's the full screen and it goes down and down and down. That's how many enemies that I have made along the way. Because I was challenging the status quo. I was challenging people's beliefs. I was challenging the victim in them because they were like, it's too hard to change. I don't want to change. If I speak up, I'm going to lose my job. What am I going to do? How am I going to pay the rent? And I say, so you'd rather stay in a job where you're afraid to be you and be really unhappy? Because what we do is what we do. So if you're afraid to speak up at work and own who you are, let me ask you a question. How healthy is your relationship with your husband, with your wife, your boyfriend, your kids? But then they start crying because they let other people bully them. So when we stand up, when we own who we are, do we make enemies? Yes, we do. But do these enemies matter? No. They only matter if we give them meaning. Basically, if we make them important. The day I made my first enemy, I walked in my mentor's office crying because it was so unfamiliar to me. I was shaking, physically shaking. I was like, oh my God, I just got ripped apart on Facebook. The stuff people wrote, that was, how could they do this? I'm a good person. And instead of pitying me, he shook my hand. And I was like, what? And he said, congratulations. Now you know that you are owning your truth. I never forgot that moment.
Interesting.
To help the audience better understand why making enemies in a way is part of leadership or part of who we are or what we do, is I call it the spaghetti effect. That's how I teach it to my clients. And the spaghetti effect is this. Tell me something that you deeply love eating. What would it be for you?
For me, it's sushi.
Sushi. Oh, I love sushi. So if you were to eat sushi right now, it would be a 10 out of 10 for you.
Yes.
Excellent. So you get your sushi right now. It's 10 out of 10. You're sure about that?
I'm 100% sure.
Okay. So tomorrow morning, I'm going to feed you the same sushi. That's the only thing you can eat. Are you going to like it 100%?
Yes.
Okay. You have it tomorrow for lunch and tomorrow for dinner as well. Is it still 100%?
I think it's dropping now to 8.
So we're going to call this the sushi effect. So it's proven in economics. So the more that we're fed something, you could say the marginal utility of consumption, so basically the pleasure that we derive from having that thing, lowers. So the sushi effect, for this example, is when we started, when I asked you what you were 100% sure about, it came from you. You told me it was sushi 100% right now. And when you said it, you were adamant, I love sushi. But when you realize that you would be fed sushi for the next 6 months every meal, then you were like, well, you know, I can eat right now. So people's approval is like sushi that is being fed to us every day. So the spaghetti effect or the sushi effect is when we try to get people's approval, when we walk on eggshells, when we avoid making enemies because we think our life will be ruined, is that we are trying to hit that spot where we will get that person's approval, when in fact their approval of their sushi goes up and down in every moment. So chasing people's approval is a waste of time. It's an illusion. It's super hard. And even if we were to get it in the moment, getting it again and again and again while that bar keeps moving, remember the sushi goes up and down, it could be 80%, it could be 20%, it could be 30%. So for us to nail it exactly, I would have to be you and I would have to feel exactly what you're feeling with all your past history and to basically completely suppress myself, so that I understood 100% of you and your perception of sushi in that moment. So after I say it to people like that, they just go, I spend my whole life wanting people's approval. And I'm like, and how did that work out for you?
And I agree, especially if you have a boss that's very bullish, you're never going to get his or her approval.
Correct. Chasing approval is actually very detrimental to the self, because if we chase approval, what is it within us that wants approval? So when people start digging, like me in the past, when I was chasing approval like crazy, it was that when I became honest with myself, was that there were parts of me that I didn't like. There were parts of me that I thought were wrong. There were parts of me that I felt guilty of or I was ashamed of. So I thought that if I got other people's approval, that they would love me in return. But true love never expects anything in return. So therefore, by doing that, what I was getting into was toxic relationships, where things are done in expectation of receiving something in return.
So Anne, I have another question. Do you believe that being assertive helps you communicate with people or lead people better?
For me, leading from a place of authority is a place of assertiveness. And let's define assertiveness, because assertiveness means different things to different people. For me, assertiveness means self-awareness. I lead to the extent that I am self-aware. I am self-aware of my feelings and emotions. I am self-aware of where they come from. I am the master of my thoughts, my words, my feelings, and my decisions. I am 100% responsible for every result in my life, the good, the bad, and the ugly. For me, that is assertiveness, and that is leading from a place of authority. I am an authority on me. We're all experts.
That is very interesting because, you know, some folks believe that being assertive is not very good.
Because they associate assertiveness with aggression. Because in the past, the role models that we've seen in leaders who were assertive, if you ask me, I would say, oh my goodness, a big bully. They're liars. They manipulate people. But those were the false beliefs, the limiting beliefs that I had around assertiveness. And because I believed that assertiveness was all these ugly things, I was the least assertive person that you would have ever met. I was a doormat. I was a people pleaser, 100%. I was completely self-erased. Hard to imagine, eh? But I've had to dig deep as to what assertiveness meant to me. And it meant being a champion for the little girl. You know, that two-year-old inside of me? That two-year-old was the kid who was slapped every day in the face.
So to be clear, being authoritative, according to you, is actually the same as being assertive?
For me, authoritative and assertive means being self-aware of my feelings and emotions, where they come from, and to master my own thoughts, my own words, my own feelings, and my own emotions. Being assertive and authoritative has nothing to do with others and everything to do with the self. That's the difference. Because for most people, they view assertiveness and authoritativeness from an external place. It's others doing it to them instead of them doing it to them.
So then what would you say are the leader's best assets?
Compassion, number one. Compassion is the highest form of emotional intelligence. In our natural state, we are all compassionate. If you look at a baby being born or a very young baby, they're fully compassionate. They are present, emotionally present. They express their feelings and emotions openly. To me, they're magical. And let's define compassion because it's important, because some people think compassion is pity. It has nothing to do with pity. Compassion is having empathy for someone's suffering, even including our own suffering. And the next step is that we do something. We take action to alleviate that suffering. That's compassion. Compassion is twofold.
I guess this leads me to my next question. You know, I was at one point part of executive level team, and I was always told, you know, you can't be too compassionate because you will not be able to discipline people or tell people what to do, because then you become too softy, you know, and people are not taking you seriously. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on this is, take a look in our world right now. Take a look at what's going on and tell me that compassion isn't needed. Compassion is always needed. I have never met anyone who was down on their luck where they were having a really low moment in their life. And someone came along and had empathy for them. And they said to them, I am so sorry you are going through this right now. I am so sorry this happened to you. What can I do to help you right now? That's compassion. I've never met anyone feeling low. That when they were told that, their mind went to, oh my God, that's such a softie. That person is so weak. No, I believe that person at the time would start crying or hug the person or go into a place of gratitude saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. So compassion, always, it's a strength, never a weakness.
So then how do you deal with, let's say you have an office drama, right, where employees are not getting along and you have compassion for both sides? How do you deal with that? How do you help them work through the office drama?
Okay. Well, there is such a thing called healthy conflict. People often raise eyebrows and go, what? Conflict is bad. No, there is such a thing as a healthy conflict. And a healthy conflict, often when drama happens, is because one side or both sides, they believe that the other person cannot hear them or cannot see them. So they want the other person to hear them and to see them. Often in office drama, it's like, why can't he, she listen to me? Why can't they agree with me? Why don't they see what's going on? So often when stuff like that happens, when I'm called in for a healthy conflict resolution, I will ask each person to sit in front of the other. So often like there will be maybe two people. And if there's more, it would be a round table or something. And each person gets to talk, gets to say what they feel, keyword, what they feel is going on. Not what they think is going on, what they feel. So, for example, in office drama, one person might say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that I got that report on my day and I've got to finish that and I don't have time. I'm already four reports behind. How could a person do this to me? And like they go on and on and on. But what they're feeling is they're feeling stressed and they're feeling overwhelmed. So when one person tells the other, for example, I am feeling overwhelmed with what you're requiring of me. When we state how we feel, no one can ever take it away from us. What we feel is what we feel. But people are afraid to share their feelings. But if we say to someone, I am feeling overwhelmed, who is the other person to say, no, you're not? And when people share their feelings and emotions, they get to resolve the conflict quickly and very effectively. Because conflict is never about the drama, you could say, is never about the drama itself. It's always about something deeper, which has to do with someone's feelings got hurt. And the bigger the drama, the more the person wants to feel seen and heard. This is why self-awareness is so crucial.
Interesting. So my next question is, how do we create a safe space for people to express their feelings?
Compassion. Imagine compassion is a place where people can share openly without the fear of judgment or rejection. And that requires a mastery of self. For me, one thing that I do for my clients is I make it safe for them. And when they share with me things that most people might, their hair might stand up on the back of their head, and I hold it solid. I hold that space for them, that safe space where they can understand themselves, where they can understand what is going on, a place where they can safely process. It's so important. We all need a safe place. But most people, they want to be that person. I believe everybody wants to be. But in order to be that person, we've got to be able to listen with what I call a blank screen. Our mind is blank. Most people, when they listen, they think about rebuttal. They listen to the person, but they're thinking about, oh, I want to say something about that. That's never safe. Safe is you let the person say everything they need to say without saying one word.
So obviously for bosses or supervisors, they have that connection with their employees. That's easy. But for the ones that are more of a bullish type, what advice do you have? How can they rebuild relationship with their employees so when the drama hits and they want to create a safe space, they can provide that to their employees?
I was working with a firm. They had $25 million in sales a year. They were two brothers who started the company. So they had been in business for about 10 years. And a few years ago, the two brothers got into a fight. And they were both managing the companies, and none of them was talking to the other. And their employees were getting so stressed out because they could never get an answer, a straight answer out of any of them. And both of them were making decisions. And at some point, one of the owners, one of the two brothers, they called me and they're like, can you come in? Because the environment is so poisonous right now. So there was a willingness that they would sit down with me and talk and see how they could resolve, have a healthy conflict resolution so that they could pursue with their company. But even with that, it took them quite some time because in order to resolve anything, one must be willing to do it. Like it's like what I call the three things. Are we able to do it? Mostly, yes. We're all able to have a healthy conflict resolution. Are we willing to do it? The two brothers, they say they were willing. They both agreed that they would sit down with me and that they would resolve it once and for all. Are they ready to do it? And one of them was holding on to grudges and wasn't ready. And until a person is able, willing, and ready, it's like talking to a wall.
So you have to have both sides on the same page, in other words.
Must get them on the same page. Must find common ground. And they found my approach maybe unusual to what they were used to. Sitting with them, I said to one, tell me something you like about your brother. He was like, what? Tell me something that you like about him. He was like, oh, you know, he's really good with employees. Our employees really like him. He's so good with them. I said, okay. I said, and well, what would you think your brother would say about you? And he said, oh, my God, he's going to say I'm a big bully, but I get things done. So it was very interesting how he was seeing that. And I did it with both of them separately. And then I brought them together. And I said, tell the other person what you like about them. And within less than 5 minutes, both of them were laughing. Both of them were trading stories from their youth. Like, do you remember when we did this? And do you remember when we did that? And when we landed that client? And in that place, when they had found that common ground, I said to them, remember this feeling. Now, do you want to resolve your conflict? Yeah, they were both ready. They had found common ground.
So obviously, these brothers were not only ready, but they also took responsibility. And my next question is, why do leaders need to take responsibility for their actions?
Well, we're all leaders. Each of us, we are leaders. We lead our personal lives. We lead our children. We lead our businesses. So it is crucial because we are responsible, 100% accountable for every decision that we've ever made. The choice is very simple. It's either we take full responsibility for our actions, only our own, or we behave like victims with a bunch of limiting beliefs with the results that we currently have. So for me, it's a no-brainer. I choose to be fully accountable for all my actions because then I get to learn from my mistakes. I'm willing to learn. I'm ready. I'm able to do it. And I can do better and step deeper and deeper into my greatness. And it's the same for each and every one of us. But in order to step deeper into our greatness, we must know where we've been. We must know what we've done. We must make amends where we've made mistakes. We must embrace with forgiveness and compassion leading the way. To me, it is the only way.
And this actually leads me to my next question, because, you know, sometimes as leaders, we encounter setbacks, we fail. We might be responsible for many things that we did that did not turn out the way we hoped they would. In your opinion, how much of a sharing leader should do with their employees or with their colleagues when it comes to hard times?
For me, it's a full sharing. Like I said, what we do is what we do everywhere. I will give you a personal example. When I was at the top of my game as a coach, I was doing emotional intelligence coaching. And here was this woman speaking three languages who had a master's degree in economics. She was a chartered financial analyst. I worked for the Supreme Court of Canada as a legal translator. I was an assistant vice president for an investment management firm at the age of 25 years old. I had it all. And in the eyes of many, I was what you would call a success. Okay? So keep that image in mind. And when I met my mentor, because I had done very little self-awareness work, very little work on myself, examining my beliefs, I had suppressed and I had erased everything that I didn't like about me. And I reinvented myself into something that I thought other people would like or would approve of. So I was completely lost in the world and I was a coach. And when I realized what I had done, how little self-awareness that I had, many people would say, well, I'm just going to do my work on the side. I'm going to learn. I'm going to mental, you know, I'm going to fix myself, whatever it is, and I'll keep with my business. I sent an email to all my clients. I had a full practice. And I said to them, I thought I knew what I was doing, but I was actually trying to heal myself through other people, because that's what we do when we're unaware. We use other people as means to understand ourselves. That's what emotional manipulation is, or anyone who wants control is unaware of themselves. So I sent this email and I said, I don't know how long it's going to take me, but I will not be coaching. If you need a referral, I'm gladly to offer one to you. I have people on my roster that I can, you know, I can send this to you. But I might be away 6 months, a year. I might never come back. This is big. I don't know. And I had zero financial means to support myself at this point. I was basically closing shop. I had hit the shitter full speed. It was like I had fallen off a cliff, 120 feet down, and landed on my ego. That's how bad it was. So people surprised me. Clients surprised me. I expected emails from clients and corporations telling me, how could you? And you have a contract with us. And all of them were like, you do what you got to do. You come back when you come back. And when you come back, we're going to work with you. And I was like, why? And they were like, because anyone who's got the courage to do this, they're going to do something great with their life. And I was away for 1 year. And when I came back, all these people came back and more. Actually, I started having a following. People were starting to follow me. And I was getting approached by platforms to write articles for them. They had 1 million readers a month. And they were like, we've been following you for years. What you did was so courageous. And you're coming on top. And I'm like, because I chose in that moment, I chose my well-being beyond the well-being of others. I chose to become fully self-aware of myself so that I could have healthy leadership, healthy relationship with others. So I could truly lead from the heart.
What I appreciate what you just said is you actually had a courage to be introspective and to see what was missing and then actually to do something about it.
Well, I always say I used to think that I was courageous in the past because for me, courage was, I had a vastly different definition of courage. And for me right now, real courage is taking positive action, even with negative thinking. So basically, even though every fiber of my body was screaming, like, no, keep the practice, just do something on the side. But my heart was saying otherwise. So I had the real courage to take positive action. And being introspective takes real courage because we get to enter the caves of our dragons, what I call the limiting beliefs, the old dragons. We get to slice heads.
But also, like, what I love about this is you also took actions, you took steps to help yourself, right?
I did. When I embarked on that journey, I was smart enough to have my mentor by my side. And I sank really low. Like I said, I had low self-worth at the time. Because when we're externally focused, we're full of self-esteem. And self-esteem and self-worth are vastly different from one another. People often confuse them. Self-worth is if you were naked in a metal room that was all dark, and there was no one around you, nothing in the world to define you. How would you feel about yourself? That's your self-worth. And self-esteem is how we perceive others, that how we think that these people feel about us. That's our self-esteem. So when I took my stumble, I realized that my self-worth was very low because my self-esteem was very high. I thought that I was the best thing since sliced bread and everything. I lacked humility. I lacked self-awareness and I lacked gratitude and I lacked compassion. All these are key ingredients. So when I decided to take that tumble into myself, that introspection, I made sure that I had a mentor by my side, someone who had walked the path before me and someone who had succeeded in walking that path. I mean, anyone who knows Dale Barron, why he became one of the top leadership experts in the world, is because in his 30s, he was at the top of his game and he fell 120 feet down, free falling. He was free climbing on flat rocks and he smashed everything in his body that was smashable. And he came back on top because he realized in that place that his self-esteem and self-worth were two vastly different things. So now he's a leader who teaches a lot about self-worth and compassion beyond self-esteem. So when I did that journey with him, I hired him because I was willing to go the distance. And I am so willing to go the distance. And I've been working with him for 5 years solid weekly. And I've just hired him on another 2-year contract. I am determined. So no one does it alone. No one. We all need someone to show us our blind spots like we've spoken about earlier.
So how do you evaluate your own success?
Very different than before. In the past, success to me meant how much money I had in the bank, what job title I had, how many employees I had under me, what grades my kids brought home on their report cards, what sort of home I had, how big it was, how many rooms, how many vacations I took a year, what car I drove, what brand. So that to me was success in the past. And after I did that introspection, success changed massively and success became something related like to my heart. So for me, success right now is how loving am I towards myself in the face of any adversity? And for example, it's easy to say, oh, I love myself when things go well. But I always tell people when the shit hits the fan, how we behave, whether we respond or we react, that's what I call success now. Because for me, I lead from my own heart success story. It's changed massively.
That's beautiful. And any thoughts on generosity and leadership?
Generosity is leadership. There are two forms of generosity. there's the what I call false generosity. It's like, I'm going to give you this in exchange for that. And most people, like me in the past, there is generosity on that definition. It was like, I'm very generous. You know, it would be like, I would let someone in. You know, when you're driving and you let them in and that person wouldn't wave at me and I'd get so angry. But I was so generous. Why couldn't they say thank you? That's not underlying generosity, because we expect something in return. A true leader leads from the heart. And when we lead from the heart, our generosity is we serve. We expect nothing in return. It's what we call servant leadership. We truly serve. We provide. We sense what is needed, and we provide it with a full heart, with gratitude leading the way, and compassion. They're all linked together.
And any thoughts for women leaders?
I will say, like what Socrates said, know thyself. If we don't know who we are, if we fail to do our self-examination, if we fail to know where our feelings and emotions come from, if we fail to be emotionally intelligent, then we are fair game for others to use us, manipulate us. We get to play small. So the women that come to me, those women entrepreneurs, these heads of corporations, they get very clear that they need to really know themselves so that they can tap into their greatness. Otherwise, they play small because of their limiting beliefs.
And I believe that know thyself can be for men and women, right?
Yes. Of course, it applies to all of us. We're all leaders. In every area of our life, we get to lead. And the sooner we realize that, the sooner we get to examine why we do what we do. What makes us do what we do? Where does it come from? And what can we do about it? That's being emotionally intelligent.
And what is your mission in life?
My mission in life is, remember that story about the two children that I said earlier on? How the kid who had had everything and the kid who had nothing, and that I had answered when I mentored, asked me that question, which one had it worse when both got slapped that, you know, the next day. And I had answered the kid who had it all. And he said to me, you know, they're children. And so my mission in life is to see the child in each and every one of us, so that I always remember that we each assign meaning to what's happening to us. I once had a client who was crying, literally crying, full-blown anxiety attack, because her bank account had less than $20 million cash. Most people would go, what the heck is wrong with her? But for her, that pain was real. And it was as real as, you know, having a business owner that I knew that had to expand, and it was $150,000 to expand. Both felt pain related to money. Which one had it worse? No one knows. They're the only ones who know. Because inside of them, there's a child, and that child has beliefs. Change your beliefs, change your life.
And any final thoughts?
Well, first, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for our lovely conversation. You ask amazing questions. You truly understand the spirit of leadership. It was truly a pleasure to be here. Pleasure speaking with you today. Any thoughts? I love leaving people with gifts. So if your audience wants to go to walkinginside.com, it's one word, it's my website. There's a wheel they can spin and they can win one of the 25 ebooks that are now available on Amazon. And I have another gift for them as well. Once the episode becomes live, they can sign up for free 1 hour coaching. It's a sweepstake, so they will, you know, they would put their name to this bucket for your episode only. And then one of the lucky winners will win 1 hour free coaching on the limiting belief of their choice.
Very nice. And how can people contact you?
I am on Facebook. My Facebook business page is Walking Inside Resources, Inc. So it's Walking Inside Coaching. I am also on Facebook, you know, my personal page. It's AnneBeaulieu. I am on LinkedIn as well, so your clients can contact me there. They can email me at Anne@walkinginside.com, or they can call the office at 1-778-888-4507.
Or they can get your books on Amazon, right?
Yes, of course. That would be lovely too.
Well, thank you, Anne. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was truly a pleasure, Bianca.
Thank you. Our very special guest was Anne Beaulieu, an emotional intelligence coach, author, and a speaker with Walking Inside Resources, Inc. Thank you for tuning in and listening to the Leadership with Bianca Kovic show. Remember that you are all leaders in your own rights, and the impact that you are meant to achieve starts with small acts of kindness, curiosity, and generosity. Please give us a like and subscribe to our channel. Thank you again, and until next time.